The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
First and foremost, though, we're going to kick things off as we do every day with our afternoon update, catching you up on all that has happened today. Conor Lally is with me, the Irish Times crime and security editor, and Mary McCarthy, columnist with the Irish Independent. Folks, you're both very, very welcome. We've mentioned Charlie Bird, and obviously everybody up and down the country, not just in the airwaves, I think, talking about him and the way in which he touched people's lives today. Joe Duffy, in fact, spoke with Pat Kenny this morning and paid this tribute.
Remember the chant that used to start? This was the essence of Charlie Bird, the chant that used to start when Charlie had thrown up in a crowd or whatever to cover a story. The crowd would start chanting, "There's only one Charlie Bird." And it was the most bizarre and very, very Irish thing to do. He was so well known and so well liked. And I tell you something, there is only one Charlie Bird. And I hate saying that there was only one Charlie Bird. He was a great, great journalist, a great companion, full of passion, full of mischief, full of fun, full of passion, full of curiosity. He wanted to get to the heart of the story. He was always wearing his reporter's hat. He used to say that if there was even a story in RTE and he had to interview Gay or whatever, he'd go over and say to Gay, "I'm wearing my reporter's hat today," as when Gay was thinking of going to Sentry or whatever. So, Charlie, are you ever any other way? It's a remarkable, remarkable. And he's died too soon. He's 74. I remember the last time we had a story with Charlie was in 2020, and he was on. He had broken this story. It was written up in the Irish Times actually about the bizarre foot and mouth ransom demand from a group of ne'er-do-wells in 1979. They threatened to unleash foot and mouth unless the government gave them 5 million. And Charlie wrote about this story in the Irish Times. And I happened just to ring him a couple of days later, as I normally do, to say thanks. I thought you were brilliant, clear. And Charlie had this unique gift of not just being a news reporter, but Charlie was box office. He was box office. And we always felt almost in Ireland that unless Charlie was at where the story was, there wasn't an Irish connection. Yeah.
That was Joe Duffy speaking to Pat Kenny here in News Talk a little bit earlier this morning. He mentioned that ransom story, actually. John Kelleher, the former film editor, was our film censor in this country. I was involved in kind of putting that together on the screen, that story with Charlie Bird. And they were still kind of working on aspects of it only up until a couple of weeks ago. And John is going to be talking about that a little bit later in the show. But like I say, Conor Lally and Mary McCarthy are both with me. Mary, you sat behind Charlie Bird for a few months in RTE, is that right?
I did. 20 years ago, I was working in RTE. First as a freelancer, and then I did a maternity cover on the business desk. So we were sitting right beside Charlie. And from the start, I can remember my first day. I didn't really know anyone in the newsroom, you know, and he was just so nice. He came over and said, you know, "How are you?" Like, endlessly inquisitive. He wanted to know, "How did you get into this? What's your story? But he used to go walking with Joe Little, who sat beside him. They were great pals, and his phone would hop constantly. And there'd be always people ringing with stories for Charlie. And I think he got stories that other people's missed because he gave everyone the time of day, no matter who you were. He'd come back, he'd ring them back. He was always so kind, even if it was a crazy story that was going nowhere. He'd take the time. Everyone felt that they could talk to him. He was always so kind and so generous with his time and just such a good reporter, endlessly curious and just such a good way of distilling the news, you know, it's such a rare thing.
Your paths would have crossed as well, Conor, I'm sure.
They would have, yeah. I mean, in my early days in journalism, I suppose, you know, just over 25 years ago, some of the first jobs that I would have been sent out on, you would end up outside, you know, places like courthouses, Leinster House and so on, and Charlie would be the guy there. And I can remember being brand new to journalism when I was like 21 years old. I'd just come from UCD, and I ended up outside a few places on my own with Charlie. And what I was struck by was he was just so high energy. He was like a 15-year-old boy permanently. He was like this Peter Pan type of guy who bounded around, really curious, high energy, would talk to everybody and anybody. Everybody knew him. And even though I was brand new, he was asking me about, you know, where I'd come from in college journalism and so on. And I was just really, I suppose, impressed by his level of energy, his level of curiosity. And that was the one thing that struck me about Charlie. And even as he got older, I mean, he didn't seem to like slow down at all. He had that high energy, high octane approach. And I suppose that was his trademark. And that's what he was really well known for.
And he had that energy post-diagnosis as well, Mary. Like, he would have been well within his rights to kind of retreat from the world and just deal with it privately. And it wasn't that he kind of took a stoic view of it. I mean, he was very honest about kind of the fears he had about how his body would react to it and how it was going to progress. Like, brutally honest about it at times.
It was almost as if he was the story. He became the story, and he couldn't stop, like, trying to raise awareness, not for him, but for everyone else who had that. You know, it was almost like he couldn't contain himself. There is a funny thing I remember about Charlie, this celebrity cookbook. They asked him to put in his favourite recipe. I think it was like 2006. And he came over to me one day and he said, I don't know what recipe. You pick a recipe and say why you like it. So I was like, okay. So I picked Thai green curry, and I went on and on about the greens and how healthy he was. And he was just like, what a load of rubbish. But he didn't care. Like,
sorry. This is a national scandal we've unearthed here. No. People at home now who have that cookbook on their shelf, Charlie Burr's Thai green curry, that somebody's probably thought, you know what, we'll cook that tonight in memory. It's Mary McCarthy's Thai
it's
green
worse.
Curry.
I think I took it off Jamie Oliver or something. I just kind of fudged it around a bit. But my point was that he was so well known, but he wasn't bothered with curating his image. You know, he was who he was, and he wasn't out for anything. It was almost like he was just out there for people. He was there to serve as people, to tell the stories. It wasn't about him.
He was involved as well, Connor, in some of the biggest stories as well, like around the ceasefire and as well. Like, I mean, he was the face of RTE, kind of on the ground a lot of the time there. Obviously, you've got Tommy Gorman and others, but he was chief amongst them.
He was, actually. And even when he started out as a very young reporter, he was on the scene at the Stardust fire.
Yes.
So that was one of his first big stories. And then
and just to pick up on a point you made, he kept in contact with a lot of those Stardust families for years and years afterwards.
Then he was the main RTE contact between between the Provisional IRA and RTE for like years. He got word of the ceasefire from the IRA. He got a statement from them. He got a tape recording from them as well. So he really had this unique way, I suppose, of placing himself in locations and by talking to people where he would get these big stories, and he would get them over and over again. He did great work with his colleague from RTE, George Lee, on NIB. And the one story that I remember from him actually was kind of more recent, and it was tracking down, was it Brendan Drum from Anglo-Irish over in the US? And the one thing that struck me about that story was he doorstepped Drum in his home over in the States. And it was the way he doorstepped him. It was, again, this high energy. It was kind of news reporting with a bit of personality and a bit of character. He was peering in the window of Brendan Drum's home. He was kind of shouting in at him, would you not, come out and say a few words? And then you could hear Brendan Drum then in the hallway shouting back at him to go away and all that kind of stuff. So it was a serious story, but it was done in Charlie Bird style. And it was energetic and it had personality, but it was still a proper, serious story, and I think he was really good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we're going to be talking. I mentioned John Kelleher. Sean O'Rourke is going to be chatting to us a little bit later, and some of the survivors as well of Stardust, people he did keep in contact with for years and years. We'll be speaking to them after 5 o'clock again. For the moment, we'll kind of move on to other matters. And this is a story that kind of, in some ways, like, is unremarkable, Mary, but I think should be remarkable. Anyway, there's a high tide in Cork, and so they're worried about flooding. People think, what? Like, this is kind of a monthly occurrence. Why are you talking about it? We shouldn't be talking about it.
There should be some kind of flood management processes. I mean, I don't really know anything about flood management processes, but it seems a high tide.
Heavy rain and a high tide. I mean, sometimes it's a lazy thing that people say, the Dublin media. And if this story was happening in Dublin, it'd get more attention. And often, like I say, it's kind of a lazy jive. I think it's true in this case, Connor. I think if heavy rain and a high tide meant parts of Dublin city were flooding regularly, I think we'd have emptied the National Pension Reserve Fund to solve the problem.
Yeah, I think that is a fair point. But I think the politicians of Cork probably really have to solve this problem. Micheál Martin has been a, senior politician down there for years. And really, when it happened in Drumcondra, which was the home place of, obviously, Bertie Ahern, it happened there about 20 years ago. The waters from the Talca caused a lot of damage there. And there was flood protection works then carried out, and it hasn't happened since. So maybe Micheál Martin just has to be the new, Cork's answer to Bertie Ahern, and try and get the problem
He needs to get an anorak and wellies, is what we're saying.
And walk around in the flood and have a picture taken.
The Drumcondra of Cork. So this is happening anyway in Cork, Mary, and I suspect it's going to keep happening in Cork. To bang on about it a little bit. We are kind of per capita one of the wealthiest countries in Europe. And it speaks to, you know, beyond kind of the issues in Cork, is an infrastructural deficit in the country. You know, be it rail lines, be it metros to the airport, be it flood defence in Cork. You know, we're kind of a personally very wealthy country, but we don't have the kind of public infrastructure you might expect in another relatively wealthy country.
It's big projects and it's going to take a lot of money. But yeah, I think like going forward, there's going to be more floods and, you know, the weather is only going to go one way. So it's definitely time to...
That's a point. I mean, with climate change, I mean, these issues are going to spread around. We're going to get more of them. And really, as you say, Cork City is the second biggest city in the country. And if we can't get it right there, you would be concerned that in smaller population areas, obviously, we're not going to get right there either. So you'd kind of hope that, you know, sometime soon they will get this problem resolved. They will put some flood protection in and they will be able to, you know, help the locals there.
Elsewhere, the chief medical officer has confirmed a third case of measles, Mary. So, I mean, this kind of terrifies lots of parents up and down the country, particularly in the context of kind of dips in vaccination rates in recent years.
They have dipped after COVID. And then there was this Dr. Andrew Wakefield. He was a real conspiracy, but he took off online.
This is the autism guy, no?
All kind of vaccinations he's against.
Okay.
And he, in the UK anyway, he really whipped up a storm. And so vaccinations, Connor was just telling me there, 88% for the second take-up, it's fallen to 88%, which is the lowest since, I think, 20 years. So basically vaccination is the only way to do it. It's really tricky because you don't want to say child neglect, but in a way, you know, what you just have to get people to get vaccinated. I would say do it in the schools.
Yeah.
You have to get permission in the schools, but just have enough education there to tell the parents, look, this is what's going to have to happen because measles is a really serious illness.
Yeah. And targeted campaigns as well, Connor, strikes me. I know when you speak to people working in this area, they say, you know, people coming from other jurisdictions, and it's not for a moment to kind of blame them, but for lots of different reasons, kind of for their own history in their own country, there's kind of a suspicion maybe about big kind of state-run programs to give people jabs, mandatory jabs. So there's kind of a natural hesitancy to take it up. But you do see in some of the kind of the new Irish populations, the take-up is much lower.
Yeah, I mean, you've certainly got populations from places like Central and Eastern Europe where this, as you say, were state-run programs and, you know, state intervention in your life wasn't very welcome.
No.
And historically that has, you know, lingered. And people from those countries, generally speaking, are not as keen on these kind of projects as us from Western parts of Europe. But it is a concern. I mean, the last time the take-up rate for the vaccine was below 95% was back in 2008. And we're now at 88% for the second take-up of the vaccine.
Yeah.
So really in the last 15 or 16 years, we've gone backwards quite a bit. Now, look, our population has changed. Inward migration into Ireland has increased hugely during that period of time. And as I say, people from various parts of the world, they bring in their own attitude towards, as you say, these big state interventions. And that may be an aspect of it. But the measles can be very serious. We obviously haven't had a major outbreak here for years and years, but obviously that could change.
Yeah.
And we're well below herd immunity. And that's the problem now, really.
Yeah. I mean, the prospect of kind of kids getting very, very sick on foot of it, I think, you know, were it to happen on any scale, it would really, really terrify people. You can get MMRs in DCU today. Fair play to them, says one of our listeners. And Andrew Wakefield was struck off the medical register for his disproven studies, as somebody else points out. It's not the only kind of health related story that has kind of emerged this afternoon. The HSE have published new guidelines as well about exercise. So you're going to have to out yourselves here. Mary, do you get 2.5 hours of moderate exercise spread across the week?
I actually do. For me, exercise is my mental health. I know that if I don't go running and don't go swimming, I will be an angry person. That sounds terrible, but I really use it. I've for years now, I've really relied on it. And I was actually quite pleased to see this because I think that people don't, it's the first time the HSE have said for children, they've given for young children guidelines. So I think it was from 5 to 17, 1 hour a day. But now they've said for children younger than five, they should get 3 hours kind of activity. I mean, obviously not doing like Jane Fonda aerobics or anything, but not to be in their pram. Or,
they're not ruling out Jane Fonda aerobics.
They're not ruling out Jane Fonda.
Let's be clear about this. If that's what you're doing with your toddlers,
Fair play to you. But so not to have them in the buggy the whole time to get, like, I mean, obviously when they're 6 months, you know, you're carrying them everywhere. But when they can walk, and it does take, you know, I don't know if you've got kids, Connor, but when you're walking through the park, come on, into the buggy, quick, want to get over to the coffee van or whatever. But you just have to take the time and let them move around. So it starts early, you know.
It starts early with the first ones, when you're all kind of conscious about that and tummy time and how much time they're spending in their high chair and all of this type of stuff. By the time you get to number two and three and stuff, you're just happy for the peace and quiet, aren't you? You leave them.
I think you are, yeah. I think you're happy for the peace and quiet.
I don't want to use the word you neglect them, but, you temporarily neglect them.
You do fuss about the first child, I suppose, a bit more than the next ones.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. And I think as a parent, you're more into your stride then. But I kind of thought this advice was a bit sad.
Into your stride. Sorry, that's a better way of describing it than neglecting them.
Yeah.
I must remember that. Yeah.
I kind of thought aspects of this new HSE advice was a bit sad. That you would have to advise parents that very small children should be exercising on the floor on their own for periods of time, you know? And you just wonder, are parents going around carrying their kids the whole time because they feel they have to be hugged and held the whole time rather than sat down and let, you know, roll around and so on.
Mm.
So I was nearly a bit queasy about that advice for very young children for some reason. I thought it was a bit sad that people would have to be told that, maybe. I don't know. But I would get my 2.5 hours in. I cycle in and out of work. And I think cycling is the answer to a lot of our problems, I have to say.
Definitely.
Transport, mental health. I even find when I cycle in and out of work, I kind of mentally prepare for work on the cycle in and I decompress when I'm cycling home. And it just starts and ends your day perfectly. Mm. You don't have to bring your car in. You don't have to spend cash on parking, fuel, and so on. It's healthy as well. And I really think for those short journeys, more people should cycle. And I think people who think they would hate cycling, if they tried it, they would love it.
How do you assess the infrastructure?
Well, I'm a former racing cyclist, so I've got a long history in cycling, and the infrastructure has improved hugely.
Mm.
I also feel drivers' behaviour, even though a lot of cyclists would disagree with me, I think it has improved around the city centre. I think you get a bit more space now when you're cycling around. I am an experienced cyclist, though. Like, I've raced in Ireland and abroad, you know, years ago. So I'd be quite experienced. But I definitely think infrastructure is improving. We obviously have more progress to make. But things are definitely going the right way. And I definitely feel safer now cycling than I ever have before.
Do you cycle, Mary?
I cycle everywhere.
And what do you make it?
You know what? I can't be the opposite to you.
Those awful wands. They're so dirty and I hate them.
The wands.
They drive me mad.
I quite like those because you feel safer now.
I'm not saying you get rid of it. I prefer them placed with a curb. You know the way they say a proper segue. The wands just get dirty.
So it's a pet peeve of mine now, Mary. You like things to be classy.
Just like things to be classy, yeah.
Do you know, Connor, I'd be the opposite to you, so I would have been very, very nervous. But I've got on board with cycling and I cycle everywhere now. But for me, it's other cyclists that make me nervous. Like, I think you're right. I think motorists, I have gotten more conscious. Mm. But other cyclists, when you come up, I was cycling.
Racers like Connor. You're blaming Connor.
No, I'm not blaming Connor. Do you know who I am blaming?
Who?
I'm blaming
E-bikes.
A friend of mine. I was cycling into town there a few weeks ago and I could feel someone, you know, when someone's driving really near to you, well, it's the same thing.
Oh, the tailgating, yeah.
Tailgating me. And I was like, who's this? I won't say it. Anyway, I got to the lights and I turned around to kind of just give them a glare and it was my pal, Ed. And I was like, Ed, what are you doing? And he was like, Mary, you're taking so long. Like, what are you doing? You're so slow. And I was like, listen.
Ed is queued out. He was drafting there behind you.
Hopefully
he's
not
listening. You only put about 50% of the effort you'd put in to do all that windbreaking.
I don't want to come down on the deliveries. Sorry, Ed. But they really do make you nervous. They fly by, they go through the lights, they overtake.
Yeah.
It's tricky, you know.
I have to say, that was the one big change that I found when I stopped working from home and I started going back into the office after the pandemic. The one big change on the roads was the number of people on e-bikes. And obviously they're going much faster than, you know, you are if you're on a regular bike. And some of them, definitely can tend to close pass you at speed. And I find the close passing from people on e-bikes has now passed out the close passing from drivers.
Yeah,
as more of a concern.
Yeah, I actually have an e-bike, but I go very slowly. Yeah, I do have an e-bike, but I go very slowly.
Anyway, we're going to be talking about drivers in a different context in a few minutes' time after the break, because there's this project in the UK to deal with middle lane hoggers on the motorway. Now, they're one of my real pet peeves. We're going to chat about that problem here, tailgating as well, in the driving context more than the cycling. But thank you to Mary McCarthy, columnist of the Irish Independent, and Conor Lally, the Irish Times crime and security editor.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.